Welcome to you all. It's lovely to see so many people. I don't know that I need to introduce Margaret, but I'm going to, just in case there's somebody who doesn't know. And I know I'm going to get it right because I'm taking it off the back of her book. So Margaret practiced as a consultant oncologist before becoming a priest in the Church of England. She's taught pastoral studies at Cranmer Hall and Ripon College, Cuddesdon, where she was Dean of Studies. She is now lead chaplain at the Oxford University Hospitals Trust and is the author of the SCM Study Guide to Pastoral Theology and is a regular contributor to Reflections for Daily Prayer. In other words, an incredible person. Now, I have started her book. This is my copy, and I've got as far as there. Because I'm taking it slowly, because it needs to be taken slowly. Now, she actually describes her book in here as a personal, spiritual, and practical exploration of necessary waiting, and adds, it's taken time and patience to write. So, Margaret, thank you.
So, as Joan said, I worked for many years in cancer hospitals as a consultant oncologist and now as the lead chaplain and the chaplain particularly based at the Churchill. And I've always had this intrigue, I guess, for the environment of a waiting room. And I remember when I was a young consultant, sometimes you kind of open the door of a clinic to see who was out there and you would be faced with this sea of faces. And all the expressions of people waiting, some with absolute dread, some with expectation, some complete resignation. And the whole of human life and their relationship to this time of uncertainty, of loss of control, written on these faces that, you know, sooner or later you might then encounter as a relationship. And that kind of image of the waiting room is something that's stayed with me over many years as a metaphor for life. And in the book, I'm going to share with you some of the other metaphors, the images, the pictures that we have, which in different ways, I think, feed and help our imagination. But I'll start with an image of the waiting room. This comes from a poet called Julia Darling. And she died of cancer in 2005. She was born some 50 years before that in the house where Jane Austen had lived, so she had this literary heritage. And in this, you know, shortish life, she died under 50, this interim, if you like, period of her life, she particularly wrestled with experiences of waiting and of sickness and interestingly turned it into an art form. And that's, again, a great theme for me. So this is her poem called A Waiting Room in August. We've made an art of it. Our skin waits like a drum, hands folded, unopened. Eyes are low-watt light bulbs in unused rooms. Our shoulders cook slowly in dusky rays of light. This morning we polished our shoes so that they should wait smartly. Our wigs lie patiently on our dignified heads. Our mouths are ironed. Acute ears listen for the call of our names across the room, green chairs and walls. Our names, those dear consonants and syllables that welcomed us when we began before we learnt to wait. Call us to the double doors where the busy nurses go. Haven't we waited long enough? Haven't we waited beautifully? I love the wit and the sensitivity that she just pricks away at our struggles and invites us in the midst of those to wait beautifully and somehow to make an art out of this experience that I call necessary waiting. And I've come across many people down the years whose stories have stayed with me. One very little one, which was so tiny but so telling, was at a conference many, many years ago, clergy conference. And you know that situation where you're queuing for your dinner and everybody's waiting and everybody's huffing and you're jiggling your trays and you know you're wanting to know how long the queue's going to be. And it's all this pressure of time and all this experience of waiting rage in a very silly and shallow microcosm, you know, the dining room queue, for goodness sake. And in front of me in the queue was this very young URC minister, and he very calmly and serenely said, "Oh yes, I practice queuing." And he said, when I go to the supermarket, I always deliberately choose the longest checkout queue to practice my waiting. I thought, I'm in the presence of a saint here. But, you know, the story stayed with me. Why, for God's sake, you know, for God's sake, does a few minutes in the dining queue or in the supermarket queue matter so much to us? And when we see people drumming their fingers and glaring at the supermarket girl, this, as I say, this little microcosm of our busy, hurried, self-centered lives. And this young minister, I guess he'd taken it up as a Lenten challenge one year, had decided he would challenge himself to go against this cultural grain and learn and practice waiting. So this is kind of the theme that bugged me and I started to wrestle with, of the problem of waiting and the practice of patience, that we need to practice. Practice makes perfect, practice makes patience. And that as Christians, we have something to learn about the practice of virtue generally. This was something I needed to think through. Nobody's born patient. I certainly wasn't. But an infant is born biologically impatient. You know, they have to scream to get the milk. They have to scream to get fed. If they don't draw attention to their needs, they will starve. And so kind of we're almost biologically wired to be attentive to our need to get on with it. And so we have to learn through socialization, through practice of different kinds, to relate our needs, our time frames, to other people's, and to learn patience. It's something that we can actually practice. But our culture has struggled hugely with this. And there are many areas. I've done quite an analysis in the book of what I call the loss of patience in our culture and the reasons, some of the cultural and economic and political reasons behind the shift to our era of instant gratification, where the whole culture around us almost makes us feel like we're a wimp if we don't stand up for our rights to get it and to get it now. Remember the slogan when the banking cards came out first, you know, takes the waiting out of wanting. And that's just somehow summed up a whole generation's need to, you know, let's just have it, you don't have to wait. Take the waiting out of wanting. And many of us are kind of driven to feel by our culture as well as by our inner needs, and then perhaps by a lack of spiritual sustenance to have real problems with patience. So I thought, okay, there's got to be a theology in this. What kind of theology is this? And I went back in my imagination to the lives of the saints, to the stories of the scripture, particularly, obviously, of course, to the Lord, and thought about how they practiced patience and how they understood and envisaged waiting. And what I began to draw out was a series of images and to realise that if we imagine things a certain way, then we can begin to enter into what that image gives us, hence the pictures, which I'm going to talk about a little bit. And because, as you know, for my sins, I'm a preacher, I had to, for my kind of personal organisation's sake, find things that all began with the same letter. I love alliteration, it kind of keeps me on track. So I experimented with different images and how they could work for us to not just reshape our imagination, but really to feed our souls and to feed our souls on the story of our faith in a way that we could learn to be patient in the grace of the Spirit and in communion with Christ and the saints. So that's kind of the project of the book, in a sense, an analysis, if you like, of the problem of waiting and patience, a sense of the pictures, the images that can feed us, and then an encouragement to do the practice that will actually, over time, which is the theme itself, over time we learn to become patient. They've got alliteration again, you see, I've done it time to time. Problem, pictures and practice. So that's the approach that I took. And tonight I thought I'd just share with you in some depth one or two of the pictures and mention some of the others, and we can have a discussion. Quite a few people are reading or have read the book, I think. So I was very tempted to just say over to you and, you know, talk to each other, but I'm hoping to share some of the backstory in doing this, but also to highlight the kind of approach for others who haven't been able to come across it yet, or probably don't want to after tonight. Okay. So the first image that really called out to me was the image. Has everybody got maybe one or two at the back? Hi. Here we go. That's it. I did just the right number. How's that? That's good. The first image that I came back to very, very often, because it's such a beautiful and rich, fertile image in all the scriptures, is the image of the wilderness. And how often we can describe ourselves in life as in a wilderness period. We're in a place where all the familiar landscapes have gone. We don't necessarily know where we are or what direction we're going in. We're surrounded by kind of uncertainty. We're in a place of complete loss of control. And I thought of, you know, friends that I know who've lost their jobs, and suddenly this wilderness, this wasteland of unemployment, people who are just absolutely burned out from excessive work or excessive treatment, in a wilderness of waiting. Waiting to get their strength back, waiting to get their sense of vigor and vocation back. People who are trapped in one way or another. I thought of friends in miserable marriages, priests in awful parish benefices, you know, people worried over their family members with intractable problems, all in some way stuck in a place where they would not have chosen to be, but where they had to navigate this harsh, barren landscape of waiting. In a situation of, to some degree, comfortlessness, powerlessness, and a kind of what we might technically call a liminal space, a neither here nor there space. It's not where we've come from and it's not where we're going to, but we don't yet know where we're on the way, and we're sort of somehow muddling through and trying to find our way through this necessary wilderness. And I come back to that sense of necessity because of the narratives I read in the scripture, that it was necessary for Jesus, it was necessary for the children of Israel, it was necessary time and again for God's people to be called into the wilderness and to go willingly, or with the Spirit kicking them up the rear end, into the wilderness, because there they would learn something new, there they would be purified. And we see Christ himself, you remember how it comes straight after his baptism, in one of the Gospels, saying, you know, he was impelled, he was driven by the Spirit into the wilderness. Really strong description. He had to go there, it was necessary. So that was my key to start to think, okay, so what is patience in the wilderness? And how do we practice patience in a faithful way, that we perhaps learn to embrace its gifts? There are practices that we have to commit ourselves to, and there are gifts, often surprising gifts, that come to us by God's grace. So I'll unpack this a bit for the wilderness, and you'll see how I approach this with all the different images. But in the wilderness, the first absolutely essential practice was to surrender. To surrender to the experience itself, to accept the reality that we are now in the desert. I am unemployed. My health has crashed. My marriage has fallen. My child is seriously ill. You know, this is the situation I'm in. And rushing this through is not going to help me. I have to inhabit this wilderness and surrender in some sense, to the reality of it, as Jesus did. And I call this a practice because we can do this through gritted teeth, or we can do it through a faithful commitment to be there and to really inhabit that wilderness with all its potential for grace. And I took myself back to the examples of the most early Christian monastics, and many of those in the story of the church who deliberately, in order to, I guess, experimentally research the spiritual life, took themselves out into the desert for precisely this reason, to experience this sort of pendulum edge of life's comforts and controls, and in that situation to surrender themselves much, much more deeply to the grace of God and to the care of God, and to allow themselves to be undone, to be in that liminal space where they would be broken down from something they had been in preparation to become something that they were not yet and could not yet imagine. T.S. Eliot, amongst others, talks about this, and if you know the four quartets, you'll immediately remember this very, very stark but beautiful piece from East Coker. Shall I say it again? In order to arrive there, to arrive where you are, to get from where you are not, you must go by a way wherein there is no ecstasy. In order to arrive at what you do not know, you must go by a way which is the way of ignorance. In order to possess what you do not possess, you must go by the way of dispossession. In order to arrive at what you are not, you must go through the way in which you are not. And what you do not know is the only thing you know. And what you own is what you do not own. And where you are is where you are not. Hugely deep paradoxical spirituality, based on John of the Cross, if you know the background to that. But surrendering to this trackless wilderness period of our life in trust that it's a place of transition, a gracious transition. That's the easy practice. The second harder practice is of struggle. There's nothing like waiting to bring out the demons. I think we all know that. Anybody who's experienced road rage or, you know, queuing rage or any kind of build-up of frustration, anger, anxiety over not being in control of time knows this sense of, you know, more or less polite, of course, rage that builds within us. And the way that our own worst inner demons just come to the surface in the wilderness. And it was so for Christ, and it will be so for us when we are in these situations, in the betwixt and the between, and out of control, then those demons which wish to master us come out to have their full play. And they may be the most petty things, you know, the irritability in the dining queue, but once the cloak of comfort is removed, then all these deeper psycho-spiritual battles come out into the desert, the demons that have full play, as we see in the life of the Lord. And Jesus, you know, we read it very graphically in the wilderness accounts. It was hand-to-hand combat with these very specific temptations, these very specific demons, as we struggle with our own sense of powerlessness in the universe and even in our own lives. And I think what came home to me very strongly was, you know, let's not waste then this opportunity of waiting. If we're in the wilderness, let's do some good struggle. Let's do some good struggle, because the demons will come out into the open where we can see them. And in the grace of Christ, we are able to do battle with them out in the open. And Jesus was called to the desert, we believe, very much for that spiritual combat, to prepare him for what would come. In the Epistle of James, he writes, "Come close to God, and he will come close to you. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you." So we're given very direct encouragement to engage with these spiritual battles that come, even in the tiniest little irritabilities of life, but how much more in the very challenging tracts of life. And my message in the book is, okay, let's practice this in the shallow end, and then when we're thrown into the deep end of life, which is where I'm often meeting people in my ministry, we are more prepared then for the battles which face us when life is really, really very difficult indeed. So there is a gift in this. That's a chaplain-type phrase. Sometimes as we kind of listen to the stories that people tell, you know, and you hear the huge struggles, and then there's a quiet pause, and you say, and is there any kind of a gift in this? Which is a very cheeky question to even dare to ask somebody, but it's wonderful how often people do find the gift in the hardest of times. And I would suggest, you know, we could describe it in many ways, but in the wilderness, the scriptures, the beautiful narratives very often suggest a gift of sustenance of some kind. There we are in this bleak scenario, and my goodness, how the manna or the quails fall down from heaven, you know, or Elijah is fed by ravens, or Jesus is ministered to by angels. And sustenance comes in the most surprising ways because we have the most raw need exposed. And the book of Deuteronomy it describes this as a didactic kind of thing, you know, that the Lord led you into the wilderness to let you hunger, to actually feel this need, so that he might feed you with the bread of heaven, with the manna, and so that you might learn that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. And however many, you know, hundreds of years later, those words are on the lips of Christ as he goes into the desert, that we've learned that we do not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. So every generation experiences this wilderness thing and struggles with it, but struggles with it to receive this gift of sustenance for life's later battles. So that's a for instance of the kind of method, the approach of the book in the first image that I use of the wilderness, which is just so beautifully coloured in all the scriptures. So I'm going to pause there for a moment and say, would you chat to your neighbour if you wish to share something of your own sense of wilderness experiences in life or those of friends? In what ways have you learned to practice some of these real spiritual energies and muscles of patience? In what ways have you found any gifts of sustenance? And let's see if we can flesh this out a little in our experience before I move on a bit more. Okay. Yeah, I think we can press on. Begun to get some connection with your experience going there. We'll have a wider discussion at the end, but I'll just touch now on some of the other images and open up the wider theme of the book. It occurred to me, you do know the etymological background to the word patience, and of course patience. When I say to my patients, I've written a book about patience, they say, which patience do you mean? I say, well, both, you know. But, you know, that word cluster of passivity, being passive, and passion, and being patient. It's all about going through stuff, undergoing things, being those who are done to rather than in control of, and are actually going through time in that slowed down relationship with time where it's not ours to command. So even the etymology of these things is very helpful for us. And patience, God help us in hospital, learn to be patient and passive in a very active way. And this is the theme of the book, that we can grow through and claim our passivity in this very active and ascetical way. So bit of background there. I love etymology. It often gives us some interesting clues to, you know, how our whole ideas have grown out of some wisdom that's way, way back there. Fascinating. Anyway, a bit more wisdom from the pictures. I'm not going to unpack all of them, but I'll just tell you what they're about, and then I'll spend a bit of time on the womb at the end, because that's a very beautiful one, and then talk about God, who's got something to do with all of this. So the next image that I was quite surprised to discover and learn a lot about was the image of the wine press. One of my colleagues in chaplaincy used to talk about the wine press of waiting. I thought, what a vivid image. And when I see, I think in the book I talk about parents in a neonatal ICU whose child is having surgery, literally pacing up and down outside, you know, literally pacing. And how often we just have to do something muscular with our waiting. But that sense of pacing and of pounding our way through time at times of pressure and strain can be very physicalized. And the image of the wine press is, again, a very scriptural one, but a rich one. I didn't know, and it's been very interesting to explore, that this was a medieval image for the work of Christ in his suffering. You may know the phrase in the prophets, "I have trodden the winepress alone." It comes in the very militaristic tramping out the vineyards where the grapes of wrath are. Yes, the battle hymn of the Republic, isn't it? It's in there in a rather different context than mine tonight. But it's an image in the scriptures, and it's an image in cultures where wine growing is obviously very well known, and the kind of wine press that would have been used in Jesus' day was this, you know, sort of usually a large vat, a circular vat, in which usually a bonded slave probably would be the poor soul who just had to tramp all day. Just tramp, 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 tramp. And it's that image of meaningless toil that is part of this more energetic waiting that I was very interested in. And it connects with me, with what many of you know, that as a personal spiritual discipline, I go every year on pilgrimage and do pilgrimage walking, tramp, 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 in that same way of learning to navigate my relationship with time, my relationship with bodily struggle of one kind or another, and all that helps us to learn of our journey through life and our need for the two practices of steadfastness, keeping on, and solidarity, that we do not walk alone, we walk with one another. And I tell in the book quite a few things about pilgrimage, but one that I always treasure. If you've ever been to Le Puy-en-Velay up in the High Auvergne, which is where one of the great pilgrimage routes starts down through France, at the west end of the church, before you set out into the mountains, there's this sort of half relief on the back wall. And it's a very beautiful image of a group of pilgrims about to go out walking. And when you look at them, they are all of them in one way sort of crippled or struggling or leaning on each other or bandaged or, you know, half blind. They're all in one way desperately in need of healing, but as they set off, they're all leaning one on another, and they're able to undergo this pilgrimage in solidarity. And I found that very moving as I set off for the first time on pilgrimage. You know, you walk with countless hundreds of thousands of others who have trodden this way before you. And this image of the wine press and our solidarity, our human solidarity with one another, but my goodness, our mystic solidarity with Christ is just so powerful. And in the writing of St. Paul in Corinthians, he develops an image, which I've linked to this, of the way that our sufferings, our stress, our pressure is used by God as a means of overflow. And this is a similar image. It's almost, I talk about the hydrostatic image of what's his name? Archimedes with his screw. What's the other one? Who was the one who jumped in the bath? This is Archimedes, that's right. I think it is Archimedes who was in the bath. Yeah. Eureka, the Eureka moment. Where when you're under pressure and in a wine press, you are tramping that pressure yourself, what overflows is this beautiful wine. And if you visit churches that have the artwork of the mystic wine press and Christ in or Christ as the mystic wine press, what you see is this Eucharistic motif, that what he's actually tramping out is his own blood. And sometimes what flows out of this wine press flows directly out into a chalice. So all these kind of rather mystic themes of the way in which God takes and transforms our suffering into that which becomes the body and blood of Christ. Very beautifully portrayed. So we could go on with that image for a long time and feed our souls on this transformational sense that none of this is in vain. This is all to be used as a wine press. The image of the watch. I don't know if any of you know that picture there. Has anybody seen this one? It's a bit tiny on here. It's in a little niche in Gethsemane. It's in a wall in the Mount of Olives there, and Christ is on the ground and clinging on to the rock of his agony in this one. And he's begging the disciples to stay here and watch with him. And that image of the watch, of going through the night of suffering, the night of dying, very often the vigil time, the time when life is ebbing away, is something that in my own ministry has been very, very common. But for all of us at different times, we are called into those vigil times where we simply are there to keep watch and to be with other people, whether it's literally in their dying or in their going through dark nights, and to hold the Christ light for them. So that image of the watch is one that I explore in the book. And the rather lovely sense, again, kind of going back to early societies, you know, we think of the night watchmen, whose job was they were the early police force, weren't they? They would patrol the streets to keep you safe in your bed at night, and that was their watch. The early monastic and religious communities kept watch during the night through prayer. And God bless them, they still do. There will be monks and nuns in the middle of this night praying for the world and keeping vigil. And it was one of the earliest spiritual practices of the church that they saw this as keeping company with Christ, and a particularly profound time of prayer to be very, very quiet before the Lord in the time of darkness, and to hold up that work of intercession, of watching with others. So lots of beautiful resonances of the very contemplative times when we can do nothing but be very still, but very present for others and as a gift to God, and finding in that a very sweet consolation often for ourselves in that watch. So that was a very precious theme to develop. The next one, the winter. My dear colleague Jan, you know Jan, don't you? Jan came in this afternoon. She's been having chemotherapy, and she's just finished, and she's absolutely burned out and exhausted. And she's been drawing on this image of the winter more than anything else to get her through the last months of treatment with lymphoma. And we shared this image together that in winter time, a tree is absolutely sort of shriveled and barren on the surface. It's just been through the blasts and the storms. But under the surface, the roots go deep and are holding it and nourishing it and anchoring it, and they are just fine. And come winter, when it comes spring, when it has got through this harsh winter, it will draw back from those roots and find the gift of renewal for new life. For everything there is a season, and we must go through our winter periods. But when we go through them, we need to push those roots right down and really know that they're there for us, that we are anchored and draw from them that rootedness and the resilience of trees. So dear Jan, she brought with her, she'd come to see me today, but she said, I want to show you something. And a friend who's got a very different gift to mine had drawn her a beautiful black and white sketch of a barren tree. And it was absolutely lovely. And she said, this is my tree I'm holding on, Margaret. And, you know, she spoke of the resilience that, you know, this friend and others like myself had given her to see this time as a time where she could find refreshment and resilience. And she would, in due time, receive a renewal. I'll read another poem for you on that, because I love some of the poets who've written on this theme. This one's an absolute gem, which isn't fully in the book. I could only put, you know, you can only put sections of poems in books because of copyright and all that nonsense, but you can have the full thing. Christina Rossetti, A Better Resurrection. I have no wit, no words, no tears. My heart within me like a stone is numbed too much for hopes or fears. Look right, look left, I dwell alone. I lift mine eyes, but dimmed with grief, no everlasting hills I see. My life is in the falling leaf. O Jesus, quicken me. She suffered a lot from depression, Rossetti, a lot. But she goes on. My life is like a faded leaf. My harvest dwindled to a husk. Truly, my life is void and brief and tedious in the barren dusk. My life is like a frozen thing, no bud or greenness can I see, yet rise it shall, the sap of spring. O Jesus, rise in me. I love it. She gets there in the end. Spring will come, as sure as you know, day follows night. So the winter has this natural rhythm to teach us that we are children of nature as well as of grace, and we can trust in the natural rhythms to teach us something of the patience and the hope that lies in that winter time. So the last one, and the most beautiful one, is the image of the womb. And I couldn't finish the images without something that was very beautiful and very pregnant with hope. Many of us know it's a place of struggle, as well as of pure hope. And for some people, the womb is a very scarred place, as well as a place of great fruitfulness and joy and vigour. But I spent quite a bit of time enjoying, exploring the imagery of the maternal womb as a place where growth takes its time and beautifully takes its time, expectantly in every sense, takes its time. And in that time, the character of the mother in waiting is developing. She is noticing. That's one of the practices. She's noticing every little flutter inside. If she's having her ultrasound scans, she's noticing every little tiny detail that's developing on them, and how much more we know about that growth than previous generations. But to notice and to relate in love to that which is growing, that is being conceived, that is coming to birth, is this maternal aspect of waiting. Not just when you're, you know, literally pregnant, but if you are pregnant with an idea or a project or a ministry, you know, something that is coming to shape within you as an individual or as a church or as a family or a group, that you're fertile with something, but you must give it time. And as you give it time, you're noticing what is taking shape and coming into this relationship, this dialogical and loving relationship with it, which must be, as well as noticing, a relationship of nurturing. So while you are waiting for your child, you're obviously nourishing it, but while you're out waiting, you know, as I am, for a book to come to maturity, you're feeding the ideas, you know. While you are waiting for the next job to come along, you're feeding your experience, you're feeding your skills. while your child is waiting to get through a bad illness or a depression or whatever, you're feeding them with, you know, with encouragement, with exercise, with all the things that will help. So all the ways in which waiting times are times of nourishing, of active engagement in what is going to come, a part of this maternal theme. But the crown of the book comes there with the lovely gift of every parent, which is the gift of naming. That what has come to birth through your patience, you then are blessed to be able to name. And as a chaplain, you know, we sometimes get called to do baptisms, not always in easy circumstances, as you'd imagine. But, you know, there's been this huge struggle for a child, perhaps, you know, through some very particular medical difficulties. And yet, you know, the joy, you know it, of every parent holding their little one. And you say, name this child. Name it. And you know how carefully you choose the name that sums up all your hopes, you know, all your sense of knowledge of that child. And the fruit of our waiting, this active waiting, is the gift that God gives. It's right there in Genesis, to name that which is being created in our midst. It's a very dignified fruit. So those are my kind of pictures that I played with and explored and enjoyed in the book. And then a final sense, do you know, we do all this waiting, but God is always waiting for us. And the ground of all our waiting is that God, aching in creation, longing for creation to come to fulfillment, hanging on the cross, God waiting for Mary's yes of annunciation right the way through the biblical story. This waiting God who waits on his creation and waits on people that is called into being with himself, and waits for the fullness of time, for the blessing that will come. So much more that I can say, but I'll read you one of the pieces that I loved from Tao de Chardin. He wrote this, I think, in the wartime to one of his nieces, if I remember rightly, who was struggling when all the men were away at war and kind of doing, you know, really important and heroic things. And what was she all about, you know? And he was urging her to take her time, this young woman, to find what God was calling out from her life. And this is what he wrote to her. Above all, trust in the slow work of God. We are quite naturally impatient in everything to reach the end without delay. We should like to skip the intermediate stages. We are impatient of being on the way to something unknown, something new. Yet it is the law of all progress that is made by passing through some stages of instability, and that may take a very long time. And so I think it is with you. Your ideas mature gradually. Let them grow. Let them shape themselves without undue haste. Do not try to force them on, as though you could be today what time, that is to say grace, and circumstances, acting on your own goodwill, will make you tomorrow. Only God could say what this new spirit gradually forming in you will be. Give our Lord the benefit of believing that his hand is leading you, and accept the anxiety of feeling yourself in suspense and incomplete. Above all, trust in the slow work of God, our loving vine dresser. Isn't that super? So I'll hand over to you there for comments, questions, and discussion together. No, indeed, I know. Well, you've had a break already.
No. Are there any burning questions at this moment?
This is a comment as much as a question. I was very, very surprised today to see something I have never seen before, and I actually took a photograph of it, and that is a daffodil in bloom. And it made me feel very strange because yes. I sort of... you know, obviously winter is, I'm sure, going to come, but yeah. I've never, ever seen one as early as this. Yeah. And when you were talking about winter
yes.
and sort of the strength of winter, I thought, gosh, this daffodil is trying to avoid it.
Yeah, yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. We rush through the seasons at our peril.
Thank you so much for that, and absolutely go along with all you've said about the value of waiting. And I'm sure you've actually used the word specifically, but another one that I've always felt is that it gives an opportunity to really listen, which we don't often seize, but
yes.
a period of waiting can do that. But the question is, where is the boundary between waiting and procrastination?
Yes, yes, indeed, indeed. And when should we be downright impatient for justice and so on? Yes,
yeah.
indeed.
I mean, you know, yes. it's obvious. Yeah. I mean, there is so much that needs yes. to be done so urgently in our own yes. society, around the world.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And so much of it seems there really is no time to wait.
Indeed.
You've got to get on with it.
Yes.
So
yeah.
we're going to put the world
yes.
to rights in our own society.
Yes.
So
yeah.
what do you think about the dangers, obviously, of waiting so long that you, in fact, wind up procrastinating?
Yes, yeah. I kind of knocked that off fairly early in the book to say, actually, that there is a very lazy kind of patience, so-called patience, which is not a Christian virtue at all. You know, it's collusion and it's compliance and it's just avoidance of responsibility. And that's a very different thing from the virtue of true patience, which is waiting on God's time. The fullness of time, the time which is ripe for an action. And sometimes that may be very soon indeed. And we see this obviously in Jesus' ministry, the resting times when he really calls people, you know, now is the time. Now is the day of salvation. Get on with it, you know, repent and believe the gospel. So there are times. And in biblical language, many of you will know this, you know, there are two different words for time. Do you know this? The chronos and the kairos. And I often think of this in terms of chronos as chronological time, you know, the ticking of the clock, the time that just moves steadily onwards. But kairos is almost that kind of the moment, the decisive moment, God's moment, the moment when, if you like, eternity intersects with time. And woe betide us if we don't discern that time. And then we are called, and it's a prophetic call sometimes, to act. But I think in our generation, we're too darned good at a lot of action, which is not that godly action at all. It is the non-virtuous action, which is actually a distraction from taking the time to discern when is the right kairos time to actually act. So I would bring the two into relationship. But yes, I passed over that without mentioning it tonight, so thank you. It's very important. Patience is... The wrong kind of patience is certainly not a virtue. It's an abdication.
How do I tell the difference?
By taking time, and I mean that, you know, don't I, to learn discernment, to learn to study time, and to learn through these kind of practices to understand the seasons of our life, the seasons of the spirit, the seasons of political life, so that we don't rush in as fools where angels fear to tread. But we can only learn that through maturing through time, I believe. And I think as we read, you know, the scriptural narratives, we see people learning painfully and slowly, just as we all do. But there ain't no formula, I don't think, is there? Wish there was. Not found the algorithm yet.
We haven't quite finished, but this is the point where we really ought to say thank you so much, Margaret. It's been a very interesting.
Well, thank you for the invitation. Yes, I've brought a prayer to close. I thought that'd be rather appropriate as it's the close of the series. And thank you for yes. Tim for bolting on an extra and for you for coming. So this is a nighttime prayer that I thought would be appropriate to our theme and to the close of our series. O God, our Father, by whose mercy and might the world turns safely into darkness, and returns again to light. We give into your hands our unfinished tasks, our unsolved problems, and our unfulfilled hopes, knowing that only that which you bless will prosper. To your great love and protection, we commit each other and all those we love, knowing that you alone are our sure defender, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.